Hey everyone, and welcome back. You know, things can feel pretty shaky right now. With populism and authoritarianism on the rise and global crises like the war in Ukraine, it's a lot to take in.
It really is.
We're going to try to make sense of it all today. Not just from the headlines, but by looking at the psychology behind these events.
You know,
the psychological forces at play.
It's so interesting how we often try to analyze these events through a purely political or economic lens. But what happens if we take a deep dive into the psychology behind it all? What's going on beneath the surface?
That's exactly what this deep dive is all about. We're exploring how the insights of these psychoanalytic thinkers can shed some light on all this complexity.
Exactly.
It's kind of like we're using a psychological x-ray to see the bones beneath the skin of these global events.
I like that analogy.
And our mission today is to try to understand how fear and unconscious desires and group dynamics contribute to the rise of authoritarianism. And how that impacts, you know, our democratic discourse.
Absolutely. And I think to do that, we have to start with the foundational thinkers. And a good place to start is Eric Fromm.
Okay.
Now, Fromm argued in his famous work, Escape from Freedom, that while humans crave freedom, it also terrifies us.
Oh, that makes sense.
Freedom brings responsibility, uncertainty, the pressure to create our own meaning.
Yeah, it's a lot to handle.
It can feel like a huge burden.
Yeah.
So when that burden gets too much, we look for escape routes.
And not necessarily like a physical escape?
Right. Not a physical escape, but a psychological one.
Makes sense.
Fromm identified three key mechanisms for this, and you can think of them as defense mechanisms against the anxiety of freedom.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Lay them on me.
So first, we have authoritarian submission.
Okay.
Then there's destructiveness.
Right.
And finally, conformity.
Conformity. Okay, so let's break those down one by one. Authoritarian submission. I think that's a pretty straightforward one, right?
It is. It's the craving for the security of a strong leader. Someone to tell them what to do, relieve them of the burden of making their own choices.
Right. Someone to just take over.
Exactly. It's just tell me what to do. I don't want to think about it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's surrendering individual responsibility in exchange for the illusion of stability and certainty.
Yeah. Someone just take the wheel. I can't do this anymore. Okay. So then we have destructiveness.
Mm.
Is this essentially just lashing out in anger?
It can manifest as that. It's channeling all the anxiety and fear that comes with freedom into aggression and blame.
Okay.
Instead of confronting uncertainty, it's much easier to find scapegoats and just lash out.
Right.
Think about how often we see this in online spaces where it's so easy to be aggressive and destructive because, you know, you have that anonymity.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And lastly, we have conformity. The classic blending in with the crowd strategy.
Exactly.
It's about, you know, relinquishing individual thought and action to avoid standing out or rocking the boat.
It's the path of least resistance, you could say. But it also stifles critical thinking and can pave the way for, you know, potentially harmful groupthink.
Right. It can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed yourself tempted by any of these escapes?
Why? Absolutely.
Like even just in your own life.
These aren't just abstract concepts.
Yeah.
You know, these are very real psychological forces that I think we all grapple with on some level.
For sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've all felt that pull at some point.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's move on to another group of thinkers that I find fascinating. Theodore Adorno and his colleagues.
Yes.
Their work on the authoritarian personality explores how certain upbringings can shape personalities that are more susceptible to those authoritarian appeals.
Right. The authoritarian personality delves into how a strict authoritarian upbringing can actually mold individuals who are more likely to follow these strongman leaders and more readily accept scapegoats. You know, it's not a deterministic theory, but it does shed some light on how our early life experiences can shape our political inclinations.
Yeah, so it's not like a one-to-one correlation or anything.
Right.
But it is interesting to think about how that early, you know, childhood environment can impact our political views. So, I mean, are we saying that if you grew up with, like, extremely strict parents, you might be more likely to gravitate towards a charismatic leader with authoritarian tendencies?
Especially during times of crisis.
Especially during times of crisis.
Okay.
So it's not like a guarantee, but there's a higher likelihood.
The research suggests that those raised in these authoritarian environments might be drawn to similar dynamics in their political choices.
Okay.
It's like unconsciously seeking a familiar sense of order and control.
So it's like what they're used to.
Exactly.
Okay. That's really fascinating.
Okay.
So are we saying that certain individuals are then inherently more susceptible to authoritarianism?
Not necessarily inherently, but there's a vulnerability there.
All right.
These individuals often perceive the world in black and white, good versus evil. us versus them.
Yeah, very simplistic.
Right. Nuance and ambiguity are threatening to them.
Yeah, those are scary things.
And so they gravitate towards leaders who offer simple solutions and clearly define the enemy.
Yeah. Here's the problem. Here's the solution. This is who you need to be afraid of.
Huh.
So how does all of this connect to what we're seeing happening in the world today?
Well, if we look at the rise of global populism, we can actually see these psychological patterns in action.
Okay.
Leaders like Trump expertly utilize tactics like blame shifting and projective identification to fuel their movements.
Oh, blame shifting. That takes me back to my teenage years.
Right.
But seriously, how does that actually work in a political context?
It's a classic tactic. It's as old as time. And it's incredibly effective in politics.
Yeah.
Basically, you take all the anxieties, fears, and frustrations of a group and you project them onto a convenient external enemy.
Okay.
Immigrants, minorities, the elites, anyone different, anyone perceived as threatening becomes the scapegoat for all these complex societal problems.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to blame someone else than to face our own shortcomings or try to understand the complexities of the world, right?
Exactly.
What about projective identification? What is that? Is that like when you dump all your negative feelings onto someone else?
It's more than just blaming. It's about tricking your own negative qualities or unwanted feelings onto another person or group.
Well,
you basically convince yourself that they embody everything that you fear or despise.
So you're almost creating this monster in your own mind.
Right.
And then fighting it.
Exactly.
Wow. Huh. How does that play out on a larger scale, though?
Well, Kiri Messina, who's a psychoanalyst, she highlights the storming of the U.S. Capitol and the Brazilian Congress by Bolsonaro supporters as chilling examples of how these tactics can erode democracy.
Oh, yeah.
These events were fueled by this potent blend of blame shifting and projective identification, leading to violence and a breakdown of democratic norms.
Yeah, those events were really terrifying.
Yeah.
How do these tactics ultimately erode the very foundations of democracy, though?
By sowing division and undermining trust. You know, when a leader encourages their followers to view certain groups as inherently dangerous or evil, it becomes impossible to have reasoned debate or find any common ground.
Right.
It creates a climate of fear and suspicion, which erodes the very core principles of democracy.
So it's really important then to understand these psychological dynamics if we want to combat these dangerous trends.
Absolutely. It's the first step towards recognizing and resisting the emotional manipulation that fuels these movements.
It all comes down to critical thinking and empathy and open dialogue.
Yes. Even when it's difficult.
Even when it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's a good reminder that we're not powerless in all of this.
We're not.
But we're just scratching the surface of this really complex issue.
Yeah.
There's so much more to explore as we delve deeper into these psychological forces at play in the world.
Absolutely. We've talked about kind of the roots of authoritarianism, you know, and how leaders can exploit people's fears and anxieties. But let's zoom in on some specific contemporary events.
Okay.
See these dynamics in action.
Yeah, I'm ready for some real world application here. Where do we start?
Well, let's take a look at the work of Michael Diamond. He's a psychoanalyst who coined this term perverted containment.
Perverted containment.
Yeah, he argues that figures like Trump actually twisted this idea of leadership as a container for anxieties.
Okay, wait, hold on. Leadership as a container.
I know it sounds a little strange.
What does that even mean?
So think of it this way. A healthy leader provides a sense of security and stability.
Okay.
Right? They acknowledge the challenges, they offer a vision for the future, and they create hope without letting those anxieties spiral out of control.
Okay.
They contain the collective anxieties in a way that's productive and reassuring.
So they're like a calming presence in the midst of a storm.
Exactly. Diamond contrasts this with figures like Lincoln and Kennedy,
okay,
who faced, you know, immense challenges, but they embodied this containing function of leadership.
Okay.
They reassured and guided the public without resorting to fear-mongering or, you know, that kind of divisive rhetoric.
Right. But Trump's approach was very different. He seemed to actually fuel those anxieties.
Oh, absolutely. He weaponized fear, anger, resentment.
Yeah.
Turned them into tools for manipulation and control. So instead of containing those emotions, he amplified them.
Right.
Creating this kind of destructive personality cult.
Okay, that's a pretty serious claim. How did this perverted containment actually work?
Well, think about Trump's rallies, for example.
Okay.
They were designed to create this sense of sheer outrage and grievance.
Yeah.
Right. He was constantly pointing fingers, identifying enemies, stoking fear of threats, whether it was immigrants or the deep state or fake news.
Exactly.
Like, you know, he created this very powerful emotional bond with his followers.
Yeah.
But it was based on negativity and division.
It's almost like he was feeding off of their anxieties to strengthen his own grip on power.
Yeah. That's a key insight here. And this constant escalation of threats and attacks was crucial to maintaining that dynamic.
Okay.
Right? The followers became increasingly dependent on Trump to protect them.
Right.
While he, in turn, derived his power from their fear and loyalty.
It's like a vicious cycle.
Exactly.
And it explains why so many people remain fiercely loyal to him, even when his actions seemed, you know, harmful or destructive. They were trapped in this echo chamber of fear and anger.
Right. And Diamond's work really sheds light on how this dynamic can take root.
Okay.
It's not just individual psychology. It's the interplay between the leader and their followers.
Yeah.
How their anxieties and desires become so intertwined.
This is making me think about what qualities we should be looking for in leaders then, especially in times like these.
Yeah.
How can we tell the difference between healthy containment and this kind of destructive manipulation?
That's such a crucial question for all of us to consider. I think it starts with understanding the difference between realistic fear, which can be motivating, and neurotic fear, which is often irrational and paralyzing.
So a healthy leader acknowledges real threats.
Yes.
But doesn't exploit them for personal gain or to sow division.
Exactly. They offer solutions, not just scapegoats.
Okay.
They appeal to our better nature, not our basis instincts. And Klaus Ottermeier, a social psychologist who's written extensively on fear and politics, really echoes this point.
Okay, so what does Ottermeier have to say about all of this?
Well, he argues that populists and authoritarians are masters at exploiting these neurotic anxieties.
Okay, so they prey on people's deepest fears and insecurities.
Yeah.
And then amplify them.
Yes, and then present themselves as the only solution.
The hero.
Right, they manufacture this climate of fear, and then they position themselves as the strong man who can restore order.
Right, only I can fix this. Can you give me some, like, real-world examples of how this works?
Well, look at the rhetoric around immigration, for example.
Okay.
You know, populist leaders often portray immigrants as this threat to national security or economic stability or cultural identity.
Yeah.
Right? They paint this picture of a dangerous other who's going to overwhelm the country and destroy its values.
Yeah.
And this type of fear-mongering is incredibly effective, even when it's based on distorted facts or outright lies.
It's like Frum's Escape from Freedom in action.
Exactly.
People are so afraid of these perceived threats that they're willing to surrender their individual rights and freedoms.
Yes.
Just for the promise of security.
Exactly. They seek refuge in the arms of a strong leader who claims to have all the answers.
Right. So what's the antidote to this kind of fear-based manipulation? How can we combat it?
Well, Ottermeier emphasizes the importance of empathy and resistance.
Okay.
You know, empathy allows us to connect with others, breaking down that us versus them mentality that fuels so much conflict.
Yeah.
And resistance, whether that's speaking out against injustice or challenging these harmful narratives or refusing to be swept up in the tide of fear, is essential for protecting democratic values.
Okay, so it's about both, you know, speaking up and being open to other perspectives.
Exactly.
But that's not easy to do.
It's not.
How do we cultivate empathy and resist manipulation when we're constantly bombarded with fear and anger in the media and online?
It's a constant challenge, but I think self-awareness is key here.
Okay.
We need to recognize our own vulnerabilities to fear and manipulation.
Yeah.
We have to critically evaluate the information that we're consuming.
Right.
And be willing to challenge our own biases.
And be open.
And seek out diverse perspectives and engage in respectful dialogue, even with those we disagree with.
Yeah. So it's both kind of inner work and outward action.
Exactly.
We need to be mindful of our own reactions.
Yes.
Actively resist attempts to manipulate us through fear.
Yes.
But also, you know, engage in that constructive dialogue and promote empathy.
Precisely. It's a collective challenge that requires collective solutions. Mm. Now, shifting gears a bit, let's consider the work of Slavoj Žižek.
Okay.
He offers some really insightful and often provocative observations about how refugees become scapegoats for Europe's anxieties.
Okay, so Žižek is arguing that even if there are valid concerns about immigration,
right,
the obsession with the threat from outsiders often reveals a deeper psychological dynamic.
Exactly. He suggests there's a kind of ideological paranoia at play here.
Okay.
That refugees become objects of both desire and fear projection.
Okay.
They represent everything that Europe wants to disown and expel.
Okay.
All its own anxieties, insecurities, unresolved historical traumas.
So they become kind of a blank screen onto which Europe projects its own fears and fantasies.
That's a good way to put it. And Žižek warns against both extremes.
Okay.
You know, both hysterical fear-mongering
okay.
and idealistic denial.
So neither panicking about an immigrant invasion.
Right.
Nor pretending everything is fine is a helpful response.
Exactly.
So what does he propose we do instead?
He urges us to look beyond the surface and address the underlying socioeconomic causes of these crises.
Okay.
He argues that we need to confront global inequality, the legacies of colonialism, the failures of neoliberal capitalism. By addressing these root causes, we can hope to create a more just and sustainable world order.
So it's about looking at the bigger picture and avoiding those simplistic narratives that just blame and scapegoat the most vulnerable.
Exactly.
But that's easier said than done.
It is. But as Ježek reminds us, critical thinking is never easy. It requires us to question our assumptions, confront uncomfortable truths, and be willing to change our minds. But it's absolutely essential if we want to break free from these cycles of fear and division that fuel so much conflict in the world.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground already, and it's clear that these psychoanalytic perspectives offer a really powerful lens for understanding the world around us.
We do!
But we're not done yet. There's still more to unpack.
Okay.
So let's dive right into the next part of our exploration.
Okay, so we've seen how fear and anxiety can be, you know, really expertly manipulated to fuel authoritarianism. But let's take a closer look at the specific emotional dynamics that are going on here.
I'm all ears. What other emotions are we talking about here?
Well, Eva Lau, a sociologist, argues that populism thrives on a potent cocktail of emotions. It's not just fear, but also disgust, resentment, and even a distorted sense of love.
Disgust, mm-hmm. Like disgust at the elites or people from different cultures.
Exactly. It's about creating a sense of visceral revulsion towards specific groups, you know, portraying them as these contaminating or polluting influences.
Right.
And this disgust then justifies the need to exclude them, or even worse, to eliminate them.
And what about resentment? Is that like the bitterness that comes from feeling left behind or ignored?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Resentment arises from this perceived injustice.
Okay.
The feeling that you've been wronged or denied what you deserve. It's a powerful emotion that can be very easily exploited by political movements.
Right.
Especially those that promise to restore some lost sense of order or privilege.
And what about love?
Yeah.
How does that factor into this whole emotional cocktail?
Well, Ilaus describes a kind of distorted or weaponized love that's often present in these movements.
Okay.
It's a love that's conditional on loyalty and conformity to the group's ideology.
Okay.
It creates this really powerful sense of belonging and identity.
Right.
But it's also incredibly exclusionary.
Yeah.
And it demonizes those who don't fit in.
So it's like a love mixed with hate. A love that demands absolute obedience.
Yes.
And punishes any dissent.
You got it. That's a good way to put it. And this kind of love can be incredibly seductive,
yes.
Especially for people who feel isolated or marginalized. It offers a sense of purpose and community.
Right.
But the price is steep.
Yeah, you give up a lot.
It requires the surrender of individual critical thinking and empathy.
Wow. This is all starting to feel very familiar. I can definitely see how these emotional appeals are being used in current political discourse. It's everywhere, you know.
It is.
In the media, online. Even in our everyday conversation.
It's pervasive, and it allows us work really helps us to recognize how these emotions are being manipulated to create this us versus them mentality that ultimately undermines democracy.
Yeah.
It's about being aware of those manipulations and choosing to engage in a more reasoned and compassionate way.
So we need to recognize these emotional triggers.
Yes.
And not get swept away by the fear or disgust or resentment. But how do we do that?
Yeah.
It's not easy to stay rational when you're constantly bombarded with these messages.
You're right. It's not easy, but it is essential. Mm-hmm. And I think it starts with developing our own emotional intelligence.
Okay.
Recognizing our own vulnerabilities and triggers.
Yeah.
We need to cultivate self-awareness, those critical thinking skills.
Yeah.
And be willing to step back and question the narratives that are being presented to us.
Speaking of questioning narratives, let's bring in Elizabeth Brunig.
Okay.
She argues that, believe it or not, Freud's ideas are surprisingly relevant for understanding the Trump movement.
Interesting.
Who else but Sigmund Freud to help explain, right?
Right. Well, Brunig highlights how Freud's concepts of the unconscious repression and even the Oedipus complex can shed light on these dynamics.
Okay.
For example, the intense loyalty to Trump might be partially explained by a kind of unconscious father figure projection.
Okay. So some people might be unconsciously transferring unresolved feelings about their own fathers onto Trump.
It's certainly a possibility. It's about seeking that strong, authoritative figure who can provide a sense of security and order in a world that feels increasingly chaotic and threatening.
Okay, that's interesting. And what about Tatiana Zygmunt de Barros?
Sure.
she brings in another psychoanalytic heavyweight, Lacan.
Yes. Dabarros uses Lacan's concepts to actually differentiate between inclusive and exclusive populism.
Okay.
So she argues that inclusive populism, while still relying on this simplified the people idea,
okay,
can actually be a force for positive change.
Okay.
It can challenge those established power structures and give a voice to marginalized groups.
But exclusive populism is a different story altogether.
Very different.
Right. Yeah.
Exclusive populism, which aligns more with authoritarianism, relies heavily on scapegoating and exclusion.
Right.
You know, it creates a very tightly defined us that's constantly under threat from this demonized them.
It sounds incredibly dangerous.
It is. Yeah. And it really highlights the importance of being able to distinguish between these different forms of populism.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's move on to Kenneth Figlio.
Okay.
He dives into this concept of the authoritarian superego.
Right. Figlio builds on Freud's idea of the superego, which is our internalized moral compass, often shaped by parental authority. In authoritarian groups, the leader becomes a kind of collective superego,
right,
setting the moral standards for the entire group.
So instead of listening to their own conscience, people just blindly follow the leader's dictates.
Essentially, yeah. The leader's voice becomes completely dominant, overriding individual critical thinking and moral judgment.
But why would people submit to this kind of external control?
Well, Figlio highlights the role of guilt and the fear of being ostracized.
Okay.
You know, if you deviate from the group's norms, you risk punishment.
Right.
The authoritarian superego instills a deep sense of guilt and anxiety about stepping out of line.
It's like being trapped in this psychological prison, constantly worried about displeasing the leader.
Exactly. And this dynamic can be incredibly difficult to break free from.
Yeah.
It takes immense courage and self-awareness to challenge the authority of the group and reclaim your own moral compass.
Figlio also discusses the role of lies in these groups.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems counterintuitive.
It does.
But he argues that lying actually strengthens the group's cohesion.
It's a fascinating observation. By believing the leader's lies, even when they're demonstrably false, the followers are demonstrating unwavering loyalty.
Right.
It becomes a test of faith, a way to prove their commitment to the group.
And this isolation from the outside world makes them even more dependent on the leader for information.
Exactly. The lies create a shared reality that separates the group from the rest of society, reinforcing that us versus them mentality.
This brings us to Noelle McAfee and her work on the concept of objection.
Yes, McAfee draws on the work of Julia Kristeva, who described objection as this feeling of disgust and revulsion towards something perceived as threatening or contaminating.
Okay.
McAfee argues that authoritarian groups often use objection to defend their fragile identities.
So they project all their fears and anxieties onto this external other.
Right.
Which they then seek to expel or eliminate.
Exactly. They create this sense of purity and righteousness within the group by demonizing and excluding anyone who doesn't conform to their very narrow worldview.
This connects back to that whole disgust dynamic that Ill has talked about.
Absolutely. Objection is a very powerful emotional force that can be easily manipulated for political purposes. It taps into these deep-seated fears and insecurities.
Yeah.
And offers a very simplistic solution. Get rid of the contaminating influence and everything will be all right.
But it's a dangerous path.
Very dangerous and ultimately destructive.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about Barry Richards' work on what he calls the authoritarian-libertarian hybrid.
Okay.
It seems paradoxical.
Uh-huh.
How can those two ideologies even coexist?
Well, Richards highlights how these seemingly opposite ideologies can converge. He argues that both authoritarianism and libertarianism appeal to certain psychological needs.
Okay.
So authoritarianism offers security and order through submission to a strong leader,
right,
while libertarianism promises freedom from external constraints.
Okay, so they're both reactions to this fear of powerlessness and chaos.
Exactly. And in today's world, where those traditional sources of authority and stability are eroding, this hybrid ideology is becoming increasingly appealing.
Can you give some examples of how this hybrid actually manifests in the real world?
Well, think about the Trump movement, for example.
Okay.
It combined the strongman leader with a rhetoric of individual liberty and resistance to government control.
Yeah.
It appealed to people who felt both disenfranchised and empowered, who wanted both a protector and the freedom to do as they pleased.
Wow. So it's really like this fascinating paradox.
It is.
And it explains how the movement attracted such a diverse group of followers.
Exactly. And Richards sees this hybrid ideology as a significant challenge to liberal democracy.
In what way?
Well, it undermines trust in institutions, fuels polarization, creates a climate of suspicion and hostility.
So we need to understand the appeal of this seemingly contradictory worldview?
We do.
But what can we do about it?
Well, Richard suggests that we need to find ways to address those underlying anxieties that are fueling this ideology. We need to create a more just and equitable society where people feel secure and empowered without resorting to authoritarianism or a reckless pursuit of individual liberty.
So it's about finding that delicate balance.
It is.
Between individual freedom and collective responsibility. Between security and innovation.
A tall order, but essential.
All right, let's wrap things up with Eileen Phillipson.
Oh.
She explores this concept of displacement and how it fuels authoritarianism on both the left and the right.
Right. Phillipson argues that in today's complex world, people increasingly use displacement to cope with their anxieties.
Oh.
So instead of confronting the real sources of their problems, they redirect their anger and blame onto convenient scapegoats.
It's like finding an easier target for your rage than the actual cause of your problems.
Exactly. And this displacement can manifest on both sides of the political spectrum.
Okay.
On the right, it might be immigrants, minorities, or globalists who are blamed for economic woes.
Right.
On the left, it might be the patriarchy or white supremacy or capitalism.
So both sides are engaging in the same kind of simplistic thinking and scapegoating.
That's Phillipson's point, and she warns that this displacement prevents us from actually addressing the real issues and finding real solutions.
So we need to be aware of our own tendency to displace our anxieties.
Yes.
And confront the true sources of our problems, even when it's difficult.
Absolutely. It's about taking responsibility for our own emotions and actions.
Okay, one final thinker I want to bring in is Paul Oliver. He analyzed Trump's presidency through the lens of Freud's group psychology.
Okay.
What did he find?
Well, Oliver's work is fascinating. He suggests that identification with a leader like Trump can actually fulfill these unconscious desires.
Okay.
Particularly the longing for a strong, protective father figure.
So it's not just about political beliefs.
No.
It's also about these really deep-seated psychological needs.
Exactly. People are drawn to leaders who resonate with their unconscious desires and anxieties.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground today exploring the psychological forces that are driving authoritarianism. It's been a pretty intense journey.
It has.
But I think it's helped us to gain a much deeper understanding of these really complex issues.
I agree. Psychoanalysis offers a really powerful lens for understanding the world, both its dark undercurrents and the potential for positive change.
So what's the takeaway message here for our listeners? How can they use these insights to navigate these really challenging times and strengthen democratic values?
I think it starts with self-reflection. We need to be honest about our own fears, our own biases and vulnerabilities. We need to question our assumptions and challenge the narratives that divide us.
Okay.
And most importantly, we need to cultivate empathy, compassion, and a commitment to open dialogue.
Those are powerful tools for change.
They are.
And they're available to each and every one of us.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the psychology of authoritarianism. We hope it's given you some new insights and inspired you to continue exploring these critical issues.
It's been a pleasure diving deep with you. And remember, understanding ourselves and the forces shaping our world is the first step towards creating a more just and compassionate future.